Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 23rd, 2015. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. But this week, we visit White Labs to talk to founder Chris White about his tasting room, his new brewery to supply the tasting room, new products, and general brewing industry stuff. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on the Google Plus as well. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link and our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first on basicbrewing.com. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you, helping us to bring you this show. That's how it works. We appreciate your support greatly, greatly. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who's done so already. We covered a lot of ground with Dr. White, lots of good stuff, so I want to get to it pretty quickly. But first, let's take a quick look into the mailbag. This is from Mark in Wolverhampton in the UK. Mark says, happy 10th birthday, James, Steve, and all at Basic Brewing. I've been listening to your podcast for a couple of years now and have gone through all the archives. I've learned so much and have had many laughs along the way. My favorite has to be the Ghost Pepper Jelly episode. And he puts in parentheses, I need some milk. That's on the YouTubes. That was a Thanksgiving extra, I think. So Mark says, here's to another 10 years to the Bert and Ernie of brewing. And I mean that in the nicest way. I asked Mark who was which, who was Bert and who was Ernie. And he said, I see you as Bert and Steve as Ernie. And maybe Andy Sparks as the Cookie Monster. Do you really know what he keeps in that fridge of his? Well, yeah. Mostly beer. The Magic Beer Fridge is mostly beer, but I have seen some meat in there on occasion. Andy went through a bacon-making phase. And I'm Bert. Bert is sort of the jaundiced pigeon freak with the pointy head and the little tuft of hair right on the top. My hair is kind of the opposite of Bert's hair. but there are worse Muppets to be, for sure. So I appreciate that, Mark. I was thinking that this show was going to mark the 10th anniversary of Basic Brewing Radio. But looking at the archives, our first show was July 14th, 2005. So last week, I guess, was the closest to the decade milepost. So seems like I forget the anniversary every year. I get all involved in just making the show and putting it together, and I forget to mark the anniversary. So a big thanks to everybody who's contributed over the past 10 years, content and otherwise, and a big thanks to you listeners who keep this thing going. We get a lot more good stuff to come. Also, a big thanks to our sponsors like Dave and Desiree of High Gravity in Tulsa. They have a background in computers and such, so their website, highgravitybrew.com, has some cool bells and whistles like the Build Your Own Beer page. And I'll kind of walk you through it here quickly. First of all, you can select all grain or extract. I choose all grain. Then you can choose to have your grain crushed or not. I do not. And when I played with it, I chose ingredients from the very long list. Man, I mean, it's got everything you need to make a beer. I chose ingredients for my cream ale, 10 pounds of Breeze 2-Row, 16 ounces of flaked maize, 3 ounces of Czech Saaz, a packet of Nottingham yeast. And as I chose those ingredients, the price updated live on the bottom of the screen, and you can see it there on the bottom of the screen the whole time. You don't have to scroll all the way to the bottom of that long list to see your total. And you can even name your beer when you order. And High Gravity has flat rate shipping of $7.99 on most items. So check that out, the Build Your Own Beer page, and much more at highgravitybrew.com. And once again, we appreciate the continued support of Dave and Desiree. This is another in our series of interviews recorded in San Diego around the National Homebrewers Conference. We've got lots more of them. And I think next week I'm going to start mixing in some more recently recorded material. I've got an interview with Chris Colby of BeerAndWineJournal.com lined up, as well as a Hefeweizen pitching rate experiment from homebrewer Dennis Pike that Steve and I sampled and judged. I'm looking forward to seeing how close we came to guessing correctly. So those will be coming up in the next few weeks or so. But first, let's go to the headquarters of White Labs to talk to Dr. Chris White at a conference table populated by Basic Brewing Radio veterans. Well, Chris White, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
All right. Thank you. It's pleasure to be back.
And we have the Basic Brewing Radio entourage here around the conference table here at White Labs. And everybody, introduce yourselves.
Michael Tonsmeyer.
Sean Terrell, Tumal Brewing.
Bob Stemsky.
Chris Sable.
Doug Wierzynski.
Steve Wilkes.
Andy Sparks.
So it's kind of like a who's who of people that have been on the show. We're all meeting here for the National Homebrewers Conference, and we've just toured your facility. Tell us what we're at. Tell us about the tasting room, first of all, how it came about, and what your goal is with the tasting room.
Well, the tasting room was just another idea that we've got a lot of ideas here, and we were able to turn it into reality. When we moved into this building in 2011, we felt it had enough space to add a brewery and a tasting room so we could show people what yeast tastes like. I'm glad we did it right when we moved in. We built it in 2012 because it would have been swallowed up by all sorts of other activities here. So I'm glad we were able to squeeze it in. And we wanted to do it because so many beer festivals and different things, we would make batches of beer, split it and ferment it with different yeast. And a lot of home brewers have done that themselves too, of course. But people are always excited about that, and even people who, you know, especially if people didn't know that yeast had such a contribution to beer. So I wanted to make a tasting room out of that, and so we just went through the normal process, got a brewing license, and built a tasting room. And we started with a very small little nano brewery that was kind of a more beer sculpture system, and we've turned that into a 300 liter kind of three barrel system, and now upgrading that.
You do some interesting things with flights. Give us some examples of what a certain flight would be. How are you illustrating, or how are you showing the differences between yeast strains?
Yeah, we sort of settled on doing four different yeast strains. So we'd make a batch of beer and then put that into four smaller fermenters and then pitch each one with a different yeast. So a pale ale with four different yeasts and a saison with four different yeasts. And then make those into flights. So people could come in and order about six or seven different standard flights, again, IPA or Saison or wheat beer. And within each of those flights will be different yeast. And we try not to have the same yeast in different flights. So there's 20 or 30 different yeast strains right there among the different styles. And then we'll do some specialty beers that's not a main menu either. So in the beginning, it was when we first opened, it was just crazy. Every day, and there was a different set of beers. We just do a different batch every time. But then it was so confusing, and lots of beers would run out that people were kind of creating their own taste sets. So we sort of created a standard menu of those beers that would that menu would last for a few months. So that's what you saw. So we'll see downstairs, and. That's made it a little bit easier to describe to people. because it went from like it was sort of chaos before, you know, it's just all these different styles, and it was fun for all these different styles we made, but now we're trying to make, you know, the pale ale and keep that on with the four different yeast strains and the IPA and the whatever. It still changes every once in a while, and we'll make a new menu and then all the other specialty beers, so that way we've been able to kind of keep them on tap more. But then we do full testing in the lab on each of those batches too, so we've accumulated all this data about what these yeast strains do differently in each of those beers, and we're collecting a lot of sensory. So we're trying to use it really as an in-house R&D tool too, to understand the yeast strains better, and then to get all that information described up on, you know, up in the cloud, to so people can access that information and really get a lot. You know, we've done a couple thousand fermentations already, so that's yielding a lot of data on what's different about the different yeast strains.
So you're actually gathering data from people as they come and.
Yeah, they can do a survey, so we get that sensory. We do regular sensory panels here, and all the analytical data about the different fermentation speeds and alcohol contents and flavor compounds from the different yeasts that are doing the different fermentations.
So you really, I mean, you are seeing the process from both sides now. I mean, whereas I guess before you were just a producer and you're sending your babies out into the world,
right?
But you're actually getting to play with them yourself.
Yeah, we're getting to play with, you know, we'd always do sort of small batches, but now that there's a little bit of pressure applied to that because they've got to make enough batches to have enough to sell, I find the staff has to do it. You know, it's not something we just do once in a while. It was, we have to do it every day because, hey, the porter's going to run out, you know, and people want the porter. So we got to make more porter, which is another experiment, in my opinion. You know, there's another fermentation to collect data on.
And I guess you get to deal with the pressures of repeatability or consistency between batches and all that?
Yeah, and it's really shown me a lot of things, too, about sort of the craft brewing industry. I think it's very hard on that small brewing system, kind of the nano brewery or the large homebrew setup, to make really consistent beer. It's one thing to make good beer, but to make it consistent, you really need the tight temperature control, and it's hard to get on the smaller fermentations because we take that batch and we make it into even smaller fermenters, right? And you can kind of control the temperature, but you can't control it like you can in a big 20-barrel tank or something with a small glycol band around a big volume of beer with real precise control. So that repeatability is a bit hard to achieve on the nano level. So that's one reason we're also expanding into larger fermenters so we can expand on the temperature side of the experiments, because right now everything's fermented at the same temperature. Works great for some yeast, like Saison 590 loves the temperature we use. but, you know, California ale yeast even doesn't really like it, and some other things. So now having the standard, you know, conical fermenters with precise temperature control, we can give each strain the temperature it wants, make Saisons at higher temperatures, for example, make a whole bunch of new lager beers. So it's going to be with this expansion we're doing right now with the brewery, it's going to be a nice way to make a lot of new beers and experiments.
Yeah, talk about your new system and how is it similar and how is it different from a standard commercial microbrewery or a small brewery?
Well, when we built the tasting room, you know, originally we really didn't think too much about the brewery side. We just got the little system and we started making beer. So we kind of built the tasting room first, got it licensed and everything, and then focused now on the brewery several years later. And one reason why it took a little longer to get a bigger brewery in here is from the beginning I wanted to combine our yeast brewery with our beer brewery. So up until now it's been two separate systems. We make the wort for yeast, which is all malt wort, but we make it in these two main sterilizers we have. So we mix it up, we make it more like a food product in the sterilizers, and put that into the clean room and fill the reactors, the fermenters where the yeast grow in. And then we have built up this little brew house that we make the beers on. So combining that together on the same big system using all grain has been sort of an engineering feat and something that we have wanted to do for a while. It just took us all working on it together. So we put a brewery in that we could make wort for yeast and we could make wort for beer. So it's the majority of what it's going to do is make wort for yeast because that's our biggest volume thing here. And we'll make 20-barrel batches of beer every so often. And so it took a little – the main part of the difference in the engineering is when a brewery takes the wort and boils it, and then, say, after that they go through whirlpool, they go through some stages where they can introduce some more contaminants. And we had to build a system where we don't introduce more contaminants. So keeping pressure vessels, keeping temperatures, and those are some of the things we had to pay attention to and change the designs of the vessels to keep the wort the same purity as after the kettle.
It's interesting seeing the system, because you have the brewing system on one side, and then on the wall you have this this double-decker line of little conical fermenters.
Right. It's exactly the opposite of what most people would build a brewery. Most people would build a brewery now with, say, a 20-barrel brew house and 60-barrel fermenters. Mm-hmm. So they would brew multiple times into the same fermenter. We had taken a batch of wort, and we set it down to four little fermenters, which means then we need four serving tanks for that same batch of beer. So the serving tanks aren't here yet. So we need four times the fermentation capacity for each batch of beer, which is a lot more money, but it's just the way we wanted to do it here because it's about the experiments.
What have you found out? What are some fun things that you found out through all these experiments that you didn't expect?
Well, one thing is how people are coming and kind of shopping for yeast based on the tasting room. You know, we get a mixture of people. Some people never heard about yeast, and that's kind of fun for them. We get some of the biotech community coming in, and that's fun for them. But homebrewers coming in and commercial brewers and trying some of the different yeast strains. Just last week, a homebrewer told me that it was at the bar, said that he used to always use the Hefeweizen yeast and thought that was a great yeast for Hefeweizens. But now he uses 380 as his main Hefeweizen yeast. Because he tasted it next to the Hefeweizen yeast in one of our flights and thought the 380 was so much better.
Hmm. What's a 380 generally used for?
We call it Hefeweizen 4, and it's a strain that's slightly different than our regular Hefeweizen yeast, WLP 300, where the WLP 300 is got the classical Weizen flavors, but pretty dominated by the banana, the isoamyl acetate kind of ester. It makes a lot of it. And you can reduce that with a little lower temperature fermentation. But the 380, the Hefeweizen 4, just makes less of it regardless. So it's more earthy, more phenolic based kind of a Hefeweizen. And some people like that. And some people, I guess, for that particular person's example, didn't know they liked it until they tasted it side by side. And they liked that balance better without the high banana.
Do you purposefully do mismatches to see what happens?
Yes, we try. So, for example, if we just made the IPA with four of great IPA yeast, I don't think it would be as interesting. So we put a Belgian yeast in there. We put sometimes a wheat beer yeast in there. We want to show some differences, but also something not too crazy, because you want to show what some things could be. So a Belgian yeast in there could be what some people are doing now anyway, a Belgian style kind of IPA. We also have done some of the beers with some of our Brettanomyces cultures, and done the same kind of thing. But
Nowadays it would be hard to do something that somebody hasn't done already.
there's so much creativity around, and we do some collaborations with the brewers around here too. So we'll make a batch of beer with Ballast Point or Border Psycho in Tijuana, Mexico, just across the border. Those are a couple of examples of collaborations. But we've collaborated with a lot of the brewers in town here. Well, they'll come here and we'll make the wort here, ferment it here, or sometimes they'll bring the wort here and we'll ferment it here. It depends on how we do it. But then we'll break the beer up into four different fermenters and ferment it. So from a collaboration standpoint, some of the brewers that come, they want to see what their recipe tastes like and with different yeast strains. So those are kind of fun collaborations to do, and we're doing more and more of those. Especially with more fermentation capacity, we'll be able to expand that.
Now, you're moving into a new packaging, and talk about the new packaging and talk about the challenges that you've had in moving that direction.
Every idea seems to be a real challenge, just like the tasting room. You know, now you had to be open to the public and create an experience for the public. The packaging was another idea where it didn't really start with a packaging idea. It started with a different way of making yeast, because You know, we grow yeast, say, back a few years ago, 2009, we grew yeast in big stainless vessels, collected them out the bottom, and then put them into packaging. So that is a lot of yeast handling, and it's a lot of kind of beating up the yeast in a packaging process. So I was always thinking about the packaging part because that's something different we have to do here. And I thought if we made yeast in film, flexible material, bag material, whatever you kind of want to call it, the pharmaceutical industry calls them disposable reactors. and that's the way the pharmaceuticals have gone to, growing a lot of microbes. If we grew them in that kind of vessel, we could capture them in the vessel and through heat sealing, and then just make a smaller vessel, smaller piece, and that could become a package. So that was the kind of the concept. Like, if we grew it in that material, we could capture that material. We wouldn't have to package handle these so much from a packaging standpoint, and we could save a lot of chemicals and things in terms of cleaning all those stainless steel tanks. So there was an environmental interest, and there was just an interest that it would be a much better way to grow yeast and package it. So we mobilized that idea in 2009, and we're just coming out with it now because we didn't realize what we were getting into. Yeah, when I went to the first packaging show and talked to some people in the heat sealing industry, you know, about this, they said, nope, can't be done. Don't do it.
Because people usually take a bag or take a tube or whatever and put stuff in it.
Yeah.
You're growing the product in this big bag.
Right.
And sectioning it off and cutting it up, and you're actually getting a piece of the vessel that it was fermented in when you buy it in the store.
Right, and that hadn't been done before, so we actually got a patent on this that was issued last year. And so I could, every at those packaging shows, they'd say, why do you want to do that? Just package it, because that technology is done. There, it's high speed. You can fill ketchup bags. You can fill all sorts of things. You fill, you seal it, very easy. But the whole point is I didn't want to fill. I didn't want to go through a filler. I didn't want to handle these 80-some different yeast strains through this equipment and you clean all that equipment every time and then try to verify that it's clean. I wanted to do this more low-speed process and seal it in the vessel. So first we had to create the reactors to make the yeast in. And that part we finished a couple of years ago. We've been making yeast in this film for a couple of years. But until we had the heat sealing equipment to do the final package, we've been repackaging into bottles and vials. So the yeast that people see in the new package isn't really that new from that perspective, because we've already been making the yeast in the film, that film, for a couple of years. But then to get the yeast into the right package with the right volume, that's taken a couple more years of R&D work, and R&D work in a small company takes a little more time because resources are a little limited, but it's been a big project here. So for example, we realized we needed a whole new building to put all this heat sealing equipment in. So that's why we built a packaging hall next door to us. And we just completed that within the last few months and put a lot of equipment in there. And we're rebuilding some of that equipment now for more high-speed needs. So there's a lot that goes into making that final package. Because, again, the yeast has to be distributed perfectly in the film, and you're not taking it out. So that distribution has taken a lot of work to get right.
And Nolan, is that your QA? Your QA guy? He was taking us on the tour, and he said you basically had a rocket scientist to help to design the packaging. Or?
Well, first it was a particle physicist, yes, and he did some heat sealing machines on the side. He has this little side company, because he was also making very large bags to study some part of his studies. So he kind of started the side company to do these machines, and we got directed to him when other people said, like I said, they said, well, you can't do that. Well, yeah, maybe this one guy can help you. So he's built most of the machines we have here. He's been an integral part of the team and is just as excited about this whole project as we are. Like, if you get excited about it, it's become a passion. So he has that passion. And then we needed a final machine to put the homebrew package, because the film that the yeast grows in is they're sealed in it, but then it has to go in another piece of film to have the retail information and stuff like that. So it's actually a double layer. So for that piece to go in the final piece at high speeds, we found a company that was started by a few rocket scientists, actually, and they're making a new packaging machine and in New York, and that's what we were able to get. That's one of the few off-the-shelf sort of machines, though. That's the only one, maybe, that we were able to buy.
So these new packages will act like the vials. I mean, you'll use them in a similar manner.
Yeah, right. It has the similar amount of yeast inside. We tried to put a little bit more in these because we can, instead of having to go through a filling machine, you know, we can seal right in on a very concentrated slurry. So we were able to get a little higher concentration, and those cell counts are part of the QC process now. That's available when people look up. They can go on to Yeastman and look up the lot number even today. But with the new packages, it shows a little bit more information. So you can see a little higher cell count in there, a little bit, a few mils more volume. But otherwise, it's used the same. It's designed for a 5-gallon batch of beer, the same number of yeast strains. Some of the strains, like blends and things, we actually haven't figured out exactly how we're going to do the pure pitch with them yet. So they'll stay in vials for a while.
Currently, you prop them separately and then blend them together for packaging?
Right. So if we grew the blends together, that would be more of the reactor space that they would need, right? Instead of growing California and Irish and other things separately and then combining later, they would all grow together, which would take a whole other vessel. So, which maybe that's what we'll do. I mean, that's probably what we'll have to do, but that's going to take some more studies to make sure they all grow the same. It's very easy to get the exact percentages we want when we add them together at packaging. But challenges like that just didn't stop us from going forward. We just said, well, we'll figure that out later.
Now, this is kind of a sidetrack, but I saw a presentation by Neva. About why you shouldn't be making starters as much as you do, as homebrewers do with liquid yeast, basically. I mean, that was the thrust, I think, of that what you're selling is actual pitchable quantity of yeast for a moderate gravity standard 5-gallon batch of beer. How do you feel? What's your feeling on it? Is that a pet peeve of yours that people feel compelled to make starters with your product, right? Or just whether they need it or not?
For me, no, not at all. It's not a pet peeve. I like the microbiology aspect, so I feel that's just another microbiology thing, doing a little culture. So I think that not everybody needs to do it, right? But I never say it's a bad thing. The only really bad thing about making a starter is the potential for contamination. Otherwise, there's really no negative about it. It just takes a little bit of time. But if you do it and don't introduce a contamination, which most people are making starters and are doing a pretty good job with that, but there is that potential. But you remove that, and then, again, there's nothing really wrong with it with a starter. So if people want to do them, I think that's fine. It doesn't really generate a lot of new cells in most people's starters unless you're making fairly big ones. Mm-hmm. But it turns on a metabolism in the yeast. As long as you're using an all-malt wort, you don't want something like simple sugars because you need the maltose in there to make a proper starter to get yeast in the proper condition for fermenting beer where there's going to be a lot of maltose. Well, most people are using wort, so if you use a wort that's not, you're not introducing contamination, I think it's fine. I just don't think everybody needs to. But the yeast that we make in that package, really, they're designed for 12 Plato type wort, right? And a lot of homebrewers are, and which works perfectly fine on the commercial level because people who buy yeast from us on the commercial side are buying a pitch, say a 10 barrel or 20 barrel pitch, and they're usually making one of their lower gravity beers for their first generation beers. Well, homebrewers might be making all sorts of different gravity beers. Mm-hmm. And so since we designed it for 12 Plato beer, and people might make 15 or 16 or 18, I think that's why people are making a lot of starters, and we've just made a table recently that we haven't made public, I don't think, but to kind of show how many vials we might want to use for different gravities, and that's just really a reflection of what people are doing now anyway, and we should recognize that and give some recommendations.
Are the various yeast pitch calculators out there, are they fairly accurate? Should we trust them?
You know, I think they're, most of them weigh on the really heavy pitching side, but again, there's not much of a negative of that until you're the real over pitching problems are from repitching, because you generate so much yeast from a fermentation. That's where the dangers of repitching come from. Using a little bit more yeast from a propagation or something like that, it's really hard to do do much of an over pitching. So. Jamil's Mr. Malty calculator is based on, he did some experiments, which is cool. So he did that shelf life experiment was based on him holding yeast and putting it under the microscope and looking at viability. That doesn't mean every batch is going to be that way, right? So he has a spot where you can put in the viability. So ideally, somebody measures the viability, they plug that number in, mm-hmm. and not going off of one experiment. But that experiment is there as a convenience to give kind of a, framework or so of it. But he's going to, this new package we made has a longer shelf life. We're going to have a 6-month shelf life instead of a 4-month because the yeast survives in there much better with higher viability because it breeds CO2 and because it went in a much better physiological condition, not being beat up, not being handled. So we're seeing a much better viability in the yeast. And so that's just something he's going to probably, we already talked about that, but he's going to have to do another experiment to put that into Mr. Malty.
You mentioned contamination. We toured the analytical side as well. If you want your homebrew tested here at White Labs, can you do that?
Yeah, so homebrewers over the years have asked if they can do testing, and testing is fairly expensive because most tests are around $100. It takes somebody, a pretty well-trained person, to do it. And so it's kind of out of the reach, and in fact, testing was out of the reach for a lot of craft breweries for a while, but now they're doing more and more testing just because I think the craft breweries are getting bigger and there's more beer being shipped around. It's more competitive. So anyway, we were trying to figure out a way that we could make it less expensive for home brewers. And so we thought something similar to what we do for Big QC Day, where we do this big thing for commercial breweries where we send a whole bunch of these boxes out and they fill their samples, they send them back in, and we do a big round of testing. And by grouping a lot of samples together, we reduce the cost of each sample. So we thought, we made a beer test kit that homebrew stores could sell. So it gives something else for them to sell and gets the boxes available for homebrewers. And so they can buy this box, which is basically a transportation mechanism back to White Labs, because it includes the FedEx shipping back to White Labs and the bottles to put the beer in and a few things for the sanitary aspect. So they take their beers, fill those bottles, put this label on, send it back to White Labs, and then that particular beer testing kit is alcohol and IBUs. Done chemically, right? So everybody sort of estimates IBUs and alcohol, but they can be, especially IBUs, can be quite different than what you calculate based on, the utilization and everything. It's got to go into the beer.
And whose formula you use.
Exactly, right. So that's kind of a good number to know for a beer festival, competitions or things like that, or just to kind of dial in the brewery. But the beauty of this is this same box can be used to test anything. Because you go on to Yeastman and you register it so we can get it in kind of our LIMS system that, tracks we track all of the beer testing by barcodes, takes out some of the biases, of maybe a label of a beer or something like that. So it's so that yeast, by registering it with Yeastman, it starts that tracking process. And then in Yeastman, you can add any other tests. So people add gluten testing, microbiology, looking for anaerobic bacteria, They might look for, how much acetaldehyde or diacetyl is in this particular beer, so there might be an off flavor you find. You want to see if it's in there. You can use the same box to add those other things as it comes in. So when it gets to us, we see what lists of tests are needed for this particular barcode.
Is that available now?
Yeah, it's available now. It's in homebrew stores. We priced it really low, so the idea was a whole bunch of boxes would come back and emulate that same thing where we can group testing together. So, you know, hopefully over time we get more and more back, or change it to see how it works better for different brewers. But they're coming back now, which is nice. Not every store has them, so if more stores have them, more would come back. But the majority of them are the wine. We have two wine test kits, and those are the majority of the kits coming back are the wine test kits. Because we made one kind of a starter-level test kit and then a comprehensive test kit on the wine side, because a lot of people want to choose the two. On the brewing side, we made one, and you can just add different things to it. So.
And when are we going to see the new packaging?
The new packaging is been happening since September for commercial breweries, because those you don't have as much of a high speed category that you need with you know, doing tens of thousands of homebrew packages versus a smaller number of commercial packages. So we have a test release in about 5 stores in the United States right now, where we're just trying to get consumer feedback, you know, homebrewers feedback and the store's feedback to finish a few things on the way the package reads, on the way the way they're displayed. And then June 29th, we're going to release California ale yeast and Irish ale yeast and one other yeast strain in pure pitch. So at that point, we'll be releasing those strains in pure pitch. And then the rest of July or so, the rest of the strains will go in pure pitch. So we're really close to releasing it now completely for homebrew. But there's going to be a mixture of pure pitch and vials in stores probably for the next year or so. Because, as I said, some are going to stay in vials. A few strains will stay in vials. And then with the 4-month shelf life in the vials, you'll see a kind of a mixture in stores for a while. But I assume by this time next year, you'll see a lot less vials in the stores and more pure pitch.
Are there any questions from the field? Sean?
Yeah, I know you said that you're seeing more testing going on in the industry now, and obviously craft beer is growing like crazy. Are you also seeing a trend toward, I don't want to say better quality, but reduced contamination? Is that keeping pace with the expansion?
I think so. You know, the analytical lab, this chemistry lab that we have here, is something I thought was important to have as a yeast company, have a testing lab, because we want to be this lab for the industry. And, you know, in the beginning, it was kind of crickets, you know, one person waiting for samples. And now it's really grown. We have a full staff in there and lots of samples coming in every day. And I hope that is a sign that people are trying to make higher quality beers. And the biggest ones that have the challenge for that are the new breweries. And there's a lot of them. And a new brewery can take a year to figure things out. You know, they might start as a nano, like I said, and have the challenges presented by the fermentation temperatures. And some have figured those out too in some really unique ways, or have some equipment that's not really very good equipment. I just looked at a brewery that they bought something really inexpensive from China. You know, and you can buy some nice stuff from China, but they went for something inexpensive, and they got a terrible brewery. That is, I don't know how they're going to make good beer on it. And so that's, you know, they're going to have to struggle with that. And they're going to hopefully do some testing and, you know, can optimize it, I guess. And then hopefully in a couple years, a year or two, get a new brewery that's can actually looks like a brewery. Yeah. So we in the big QC day that we do, when we get, you know, hundreds of different breweries sending in samples, well, we see about 10% of those samples with some level of contamination. Okay. And that started out maybe at 15% or 20 10 years ago when we started, and now it's closer to 10 or 8. So we've seen those numbers come down, and they're not all massively contaminated where they are, but still, I think, I don't know what the ideal number is, but I think it should be closer to 2 or 3%.
When you'd hope that the brewery's sending stuff in or worried about it, and that may be part of the reason they're sending it in.
Right.
Maybe it doesn't represent what the real random sample would be.
But some of the breweries that I've talked to that when I go visit or something, they said, hey, they send their big QC day, you know, because they do it because it's only, you know, $100 or so, and so that's their... They do that twice a year, so that's their kind of yearly testing. But when they get, so I've been told a few times that when they've gotten positive micro numbers, it's made them go clean up. They didn't even realize it. Yeah. And so then they wait a whole, you know, whole other year and do it again, and all it's clean, and they feel really good about that. So it kind of, you know. And that,
I think you're talking about an email I sent you after a QC day about 2 years ago.
Great.
On those results.
Yeah, because if the contamination's not terribly rampant, you might not even notice it. But it's making little bits of off flavors and maybe some diacetyl once in a while and things like that could be eliminated with cleaning up the brewery. And a lot of that is just the cold wort side of it. You know, when wort gets cold, it's a great growth media for everything. So you kind of have to take off your cooking hat and put on your microbiologist hat and keep the brewer's yeast the only thing in that beer. And that's really actually a hard thing to do. But most breweries can do it with the right equipment, the training, and once in a while looking at the samples. Because otherwise, as I said, you almost never know if there's something there. So I think it's incredible from a microbiology perspective that we can even do this as an industry. Make beers with no other organisms that you can culture out of the, you know, because it's brewer's yeast.
And historically, I guess through time, that wasn't done. I mean, single strain beers back in the old days, you know, especially when they didn't know what yeast was, didn't exist.
So, right. We like to celebrate that here. The birthday of pure culture was November 12, 1883. That was the first day that Carlsberg Brewery used their purified lager yeast to make a batch of beer with in Copenhagen. And they said, this is, wow, this makes great beer. It's pure culture. And they supplied that free to breweries throughout Europe and the world, said, hey, this is going to make your beer better. Here you go, everyone. And that was a pretty great gesture. And that's what I think helped spread lager yeast all over around the world, maybe unfortunately.
Yeah. You're celebrating that day.
Yeah. But all of a sudden people could make beer with this pure culture, and it was lager yeast, so it ferment cold, which allowed you to make pure, you know, beer with less contamination without the tools of microbiology still, because the cool temperatures prevented a lot of organisms from growing. But now we can make pure cultures out of everything, and ale yeast are just as pure as lager strains. So, you know, ale yeast have more flavor, usually at the higher fermentation temperatures, so it most of brewers and craft brewers are using ale yeast now.
Are you getting any people who have done quote-unquote spontaneous fermentations and are wanting to isolate those yeast strains or whatever's in that beer to try to propagate it again? Or
yeah, we do a lot of yeast isolations for different breweries and people and our own collections. But yeah, most of those strains are going to be, anything from the wild is going to be pretty phenolic, because that's what most yeast do. The fact that ale yeast and lager yeast don't make phenolic compounds is because of mutation. That's why most people, when they harvest, when they get something like that, they say it tastes more like a Belgian beer, because Belgian-style yeast strains also make phenolic compounds. So if you're, you know, if you're okay with making more wild-tasting beer, there's a whole bunch of yeast strains that could be used for that, things that could be isolated from your backyard to other yeast strains that are in banks like ours.
Questions?
You know, when we went on the tour, it really drove home just how, you know, clean the facilities need to be to protect these isolated strains. And I was curious, you know, internally, do you have to do special things to protect, you know, the strains from each other to make sure that, you know, some California doesn't sneak into your Belgian propagation? And does all that algebra change when you start handling, like, the wild funky critters, the Brettanomyces?
Yeah, exactly. So even when you're walking around here on the tour, you're kind of walking around the periphery of the labs, you know. And so what goes on inside the labs and the clean room where the yeast grows in is a lot of precautions, a lot of aseptic technique, a lot of air handling. And each room has a different air handling system. The yeast, the Brett and bacteria are made in a different lab in a different area. Within that where you're walking around, but it's got its own air handling system, and everything's done in that one lab, so we don't spread any of those organisms elsewhere. So, yeah, a lot of SOPs, a lot of work to make sure that the strains are the strains that we're trying to grow. They haven't mutated. So there's a lot of work done on the plates and freezes levels in the lab, and testing, a lot of PCR work here to make sure that to amplify little bits of the DNA to make sure the strains are different. And then on the other other side of it, we hired a postdoc person this year from that just received her PhD from UC San Diego, and she's helping on this whole DNA sequencing project that we have. That's a big collaboration here with people in San Diego and a company called Illumina, which makes some high-throughput DNA sequencing machines. And we're trying to be, in this collaboration, the first group to completely sequence brewer's yeast. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing it on just one strain of brewer's yeast. We're doing it on about 200 strains.
Wow.
So we're working on a publication now of this data. And I think that's going to be kind of exciting because we don't know why yeast are different right now. Is it because of different mutations that built up in different strains? You know, we know that yeast strains, for example, make different types of esters, and that's strain dependent. But why? So with this DNA sequencing, we're seeing that, you know, certain strains have more of that gene amplified, more copies of it. And we're building this big family tree of these 200 yeast strains, how they're related to each other. And that's going to be kind of interesting for brewers. And then when more and more strains keep getting added into that, we're going to have a great picture of the evolution of brewer's yeast, how maybe to design new strains based on that, or isolate new strains, you know, through maybe non-recombinant ways. So that's another exciting project that's going on here too, that hasn't made its really headlines yet.
Yeah, GMO is a dirty word nowadays, but is that on the horizon?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we don't grow any GMO strains here, and I think it's pretty cool that all these strains that we're using have been, they're highly mutated, but that's happened through nature, that's happened through brewers working with yeast and selecting what changed based on a positive characteristic. So I don't really see that changing anytime soon. You know, maybe it could change overnight, I don't know, but I don't see it changing anytime soon. I just think that maybe through the sequencing project, if you see that there are two strains similar to each other, maybe, you know, then maybe they'll be able to mate and make a different strain. So through real classical methods, which you haven't been really able to get brewer's yeast to mate before, but maybe because we're trying to mate the wrong ones.
You know? Omega yeast has one that they've done some genetic techniques on to mate together. They have a saison that they made together, a French saison, a classic saison.
Yeah, well, here's the problem. Yeah, the problem with that, without complete genome sequencing, you don't really know exactly what happened. You know bits of what happened from PCR. So through the complete genome sequencing, I think we're going to find things that we didn't. We're going to have to reclassify other yeast strains besides what we just did recently with Brettanomyces. But I think other strains, maybe some of the lager strains, are actually ale strains, you know, or are hybrids. Yeah. That are, say, that's why they look like lager strains, but they actually have all this ale yeast DNA, for example, or from a different strain. So the whole genome sequencing, as it's done for every organism, organisms that are done this way, it leads to reclassification, it leads to a re-understanding of what's happened.
And do you think the things you're going to find out from that will change the way you suggest using the strains, or just give areas for, you know, further research, or do you think it's just sort of an interesting tidbit that, you know?
I think it's interesting. I think it will lead to more research, but I think it's going to lead to more information. Just like when Louis Pasteur, you know, said that, hey, yeast causes fermentation. It didn't change brewers overnight because they were already using yeast. It's not like they said, oh, I should use yeast now, you know. But since they knew it was yeast, they just got better at using yeast. And then they purified it. Then they learned how to keep it more healthy. Then they learned the flavors that were coming from were important. So,
it would be tempting if you knew the genome, if you knew what bits and pieces of the DNA did the different tricks. It would be tempting to take a little bit from here and a little bit from there and
right.
make a, you know,
take the attenuation gene from one and stick it into
I really like this characteristic of this yeast and this characteristic of this yeast. Let's put them together, you know, in a genetically modified kind of way.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you could do some of that now. There was a brewer's yeast that was a GMO strain that was made with amylase genes in it, so it could ferment starch.
Huh.
So you wouldn't even have to do a mash. but breweries never used it, you know. So these are fun little things made for research. But a GMO strain, you know, there's a whole FDA certification process that you'd have to do,
and the marketing side of things would be very difficult nowadays.
Right. So, and large breweries, for example, they know that there's some benefits of using a GMO strain, but the idea is, the thinking is, those benefits are so small compared to the negative reaction that could come from the public, it's not worth their investment.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the pockets of the world are very against GMO. Not so much in the United States, but it's certainly controversial here, but it's even more in other parts of the world, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, so...
Very good. Well, we've had a good conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot. Enjoyed the tour, and now it's getting close to serving time, is it
yeah.
not?
So bar opens in 15 minutes. Okay. I could make it now.
Oh, you could. Our friend Chris White.
The license is fine. It's not a licensing thing. All we have to do is open the taps now.
Well, there you go. Thank you very much for being on the show again. I'm so happy that we got the chance to come by.
Great. Thank you. Come again.
Well, thanks again to Dr. Chris White, everybody around the table. We went down to that tasting room afterwards and sampled some of the flights, and my favorite was the Saison flight. And I was especially interested in comparing the French Saison yeast to the Belgian Saison yeast, and I thought both were very tasty, but I preferred the Belgian version myself. But the Porter and Pale Ale flights were fun as well. And we shared those with each other, so I didn't have three whole flights of beer. And it's a good thing because we went to Modern Times after that. And we recorded some good stuff there, too, which is also coming up in the next few weeks. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form at basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. You get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. If there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Maverick ET733 Long Range Wireless Dual Probe Barbecue Smoker Meat Thermometer Set. Cool. And Celsius Floating Water Hammock. I don't know why that phrase, floating water hammock, it's funny to me. Thanks. I'm sure it's enjoyable to be in a floating water hammock. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio on our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voice, and we'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.